I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hello, welcome along to Writer's Routine. This week, our guest sharing the inside story of his working day is Pete Brown. He's got, I honestly think, one of the best jobs in the world. He's been British Beer Writer of the Year three times. He's won three Fortnum & Mason Food & Drink Awards. He is the chair of the British Guild of Beer Writers. He's a beer writer, a food and drink writer, I think, to do him real justice. Now, we mainly chat in this episode about his newest book, High Fidelity, love the name. It's an exploration of British food culture. We talk about why he felt compelled to write it, to right the wrongs that so many feel about food that's from the UK. We also talk about how his writing routine and the process of telling a story for him has changed over the years. And we find out how now he very much enjoys the writing voice. And the part where he actually puts the words onto the page in as descriptive a way as he can.
That's the aspect of writing that's really surprised me. When a rope man walks into a pub, which I struggle to read these days if I pick it up, I'm so embarrassed by it. And I thought, well, I'm writing this because I'm a fluent writer. I can put words together in the right order. I'm an engaging, readable writer. My prose style is quite simple. But I'm never going to be a writer. And then around the time of Hops and Glory, my prose started to become a lot more lyrical because just the things I saw were amazing, and I was looking for words to help describe them. And the biggest surprise for me has been the development of my tone of voice, because it's still simple and readable. People still say to me, "Oh, reading your book is just like talking to you." It's like, no, it's not. It's not. Transcribe my speech and you'll see how different it is. But it's good that people think that.
So stick around, more on the way with the fantastic Pete Brown this week in Writer's Routine. Yes, welcome along. Thank you so much for listening. My name's Dan Simpson. This is Writer's Routine, the show where we take a sneak peek inside the working day of some of the most successful writers to see how they get stuff done, how they get their ideas from their head onto the page and plan their day around that. This week, our guest is Pete Brown. As I said, he's a beer writer. I mean, come on. Come on. One of the best jobs I could honestly imagine, like writing, actually being paid to write about food and drink and explore what there is out there. I mean, to be honest, calling him a beer writer is a little bit of a disservice. He's got a brilliant knack of finding historical and social connections in how he writes about booze. And I think it's really worthwhile on the show to help the way that we work, to chat to all sorts of the different writers that there are, to stray from fiction to other more unique aspects of writing, to learn from their day. Now, we talk about his newest book, High Fidelity, also about Shakespeare's Local, which is the story that got me into Pete's writing. It's history seen through the eye of one pub on the river in London. And we talk about the moment that he got the first initial idea for that book. And we also chat about his very first book. It's Man Walks Into a Pub. And we do something that I very rarely do on this show. We actually tell the story of how Pete became a writer. Normally, I'll be honest, I'm not really that bothered about that side of things. I prefer focusing on the process of one particular novel. But I think with Pete, it's quite fascinating how he ended up doing what he does for a living. It's not like when you leave school, you think, I'm going to become a beer writer. A lot of different things have to fall in place for that to happen. So we'll talk to Pete about how he made it work. Also, we'll find out how he stumbled across the Pomodoro technique, why the planning of his work through the years has been affected directly by analysis that he has done himself. Before we get into it, I've got two warnings. One, there is a little bit of fruity language in there, so just be aware if you're listening in the car with kids or whatever. And also, warning two, because I'm so amazed by Pete's job, and I do read his stuff quite a lot, I got a little bit fanboy-y. Not too fanboy-y, don't be put off, just a little bit. But I think it's all a good thing. I think it's fine to be fascinated by someone who is so passionate about something and knows so much about the history of how that thing came to be. I think it's a really brilliant chat. I hope you stick around. And we start, as always, with what Pete Brown sees around him in the place where he sits down to write. And for this one, I was actually there with him recording in his writing room.
So I'm in my study in my house. My commute is walk down 12 steps from the bedroom. I've got a desk with an overflowing in tray and a big notice board behind it. And on behind me, a massive shelf full of books, most of them about beer and pubs.
It's very rare that I get the chance to actually sit in the place where people sit down to write. Usually we're squirreled away in a publisher's office or something. And what I can notice to my right, which is behind you, which is interesting, you've got a whole wall filled with different coloured post-it notes.
Yes.
Can you just tell us what's on them, why they're different colours, what it's all about?
Yeah, so this is a book I'm writing. This is my current work in progress, which is a total vanity project. When I write books at the moment with big publishers, we're always obviously thinking about commercials and things like that, as well as what I'd like to write. And this is a book that I'm writing between the gaps, which is just something I really want to write. And it's a book about the notion of craft, obviously coming at it from a beer point of view, but exploring the broader notion of craft and its thousand-year history and the arts and crafts movement, the difference between craft, art, and design, the motivations of craftspeople, the whole thing about knowledge, different types of knowledge, like the innate knowledge of someone who works with a material versus the learned knowledge of an intellectual and that kind of stuff. So trying to apply all these big concepts and then back to craft beer and go, what does this tell us about craft beer? And so I'm well into it now, and I've planned books this way since I wrote my fourth book, Shakespeare's Local. Because when my writing works best, it weaves together lots of different strands. You know, there's usually a strand of my personal experience, my travelogue, my journey, if you like. There's obviously always a big part of historical context. There might be some other academic writing around the subjects that I want to engage in. And what it is that a good chapter for me has elements of all those things. So the different coloured post-its represent different threads. So yellow is any big controversial ideas I've had while I've been reading. The dark pink is stuff about the brewing industry and the craft brewing industry. Orange is the history of craft as a concept and so on. So while I'm reading, while I'm making notes, while I'm thinking, every note, every insight, everything I get goes onto a post-it note like that.
I'm enjoying looking at some of the controversial ones on the yellow. Craft is selfish.
Yes.
Which I like that. Although you've got the different colours, is there an order as to why they are placed the way where they are?
Not yet. What happens when I've got all my thinking up on the wall, and it's just each one is like, it might be a paragraph, it might be a page, it might be a few pages, whatever. What I then start to do to plan the structure of the book is then move those post-its around and start to put the ones that belong together into groups. And that's how the narrative thread of the book evolves. So there's a lot of stuff on there, for example, about the arts and crafts movement and the politics behind that and why it ultimately failed and the similarities between that and the craft beer movement today. And so everything that's to do with that might coalesce into a group, and hopefully that group will have all the different colours within it, which shows it's a very multifaceted chapter. And eventually, once I've finished, there'll be maybe between 5 and 7 clusters up there, and that will be my chapter. And then I'll put them in order in neat little lines, and then there's the structure of the book.
Before we clicked record, you were telling me how you got into this. Now, I said we wouldn't cover the whole thing, but I just thought I would really touch upon the fact that you have an incredible job. And it all stemmed from you not managing to write a fiction book.
Yes.
You're an incredibly successful non-fiction writer, British Beer Writer of the Year 3 times. What was it about writing fiction that didn't quite work out for you?
I think I couldn't have answered that when I was trying to write it, because I thought I was going to write something amazing. And in retrospect, what it is, and this is maybe, if I was independently wealthy, I could probably work on this. But I can spot a great story from a mile away. And once I've spotted that story, once I've unearthed it, I can tell that story in an engaging way, with offshoots and tangents and a clear narrative thread. I cannot come up with that story on my own. I simply can't. I've had an idea for a novel sitting in my head for about the past 5 years, and I know it's good because the main character is not like me in any way. a novel's a failure when it's you in disguise as the main protagonist, because you're working through some issues. And this guy is not me, is nothing like me. I know what he eats, I know what he watches on TV, I know what he looks like, I know what he does, I know his history. And it's like he's standing in a closet and I can't animate him. I can't make him move. I don't know what he does next. I don't know what he does on page one. I don't know what he does between page one and the final page of the novel. I simply can't assign a plot to this character. Whereas when I write nonfiction, the story's already there. And all I've got to do is put some style in it, tell it in a way that no one's told it before, link it to things that people haven't linked it to before, and I find that a lot easier.
Do you think there'll ever be something which might open the closet for you, so you know what this guy is going to do? Do you, that kick up the backside
know.
That
he's,
you need?
He's been standing there for 5 years now. and I know some novelists, and I know I've read a lot. Obviously, I've read a lot about how to write fiction. And I know there are exercises you can do, and I know some of my favourite novelists will just start writing and see what he does. He's walking down a street and some random person comes up to him and the thing happens, and that might be the key. I know several thriller and mystery writers, and you know, halfway through the book they don't know who's done it. they don't know how it's going to end, and they just kind of wait and the characters drive them along. So I know that if I was to ask anyone for help, I'm pretty sure that's what they would tell me. But it's a confidence thing. My writing in nonfiction improved in exact lockstep with my confidence as a writer. It's like, I'm going to try this now. And I just don't have the confidence in nonfiction. Sorry, I don't have the confidence in fiction yet to attempt it. And I also don't have the time. So I used to work in advertising. And by the way, this whole kind of mental mapping process here is very much kind of drawn from advertising strategy and that kind of stuff. It's a very strategic approach. And I liked advertising because it teaches you how to think for yourself. If you can't think for yourself to start with, you're not going to succeed in the job that I was doing, but kind of advertising strategy. And my job was involved understanding people and what makes them work. So you can immediately see the link from there to writing. And a lot of advertising people do become writers. And I was working on beer, which I loved, and I felt a connection with the beer market that I hadn't felt with washing powder, for example, curiously enough. So one of the things I used to do was focus groups, which is amazing because you sit behind a two-way mirror and watch people talking about ideas and concepts and about their lives and about what interests them, what motivates them. And I noticed when people did that with beer, people either lean back or they lean forward. And people were leaning forward in a beer discussion more than I'd seen them for anything else. I mean, even when you're talking about talking to blokes about cars or even football or something, they seem more engaged about talking about their favourite beer brands than anything else. And I thought, why is that? And so I went to look for a book that would give me some kind of social and cultural history around beer and pubs. And none of the books on beer I could find were telling that story. They were saying, here are the 100 best real ales in the world, or here's an encyclopedia of beer, or here's how beer is made, all which have a place, but it wasn't the book I was looking for. And then one day I was sitting there, the 12th of September 1998, I was sitting there going, why can't I find this book? And I found a book in America about the American beer market that was very similar to what I wanted to read. I was going, why hasn't anyone done this for the UK? And then I thought, no one's done this for the UK. I'll do it. And I had the knowledge from advertising, I had the insight. And it was going to be a book about modern beer marketing with an introductory chapter on the history of beer. And then that introductory chapter became two chapters. Then it became three chapters. And then it became the entire book with one chapter on the modern marketing of beer tacked on at the end. Because what I'm talking about with Uncovering Stories, I'd be sitting reading big weighty tomes in the British Library, and you'd get something like, in 1810, the price of hops was this much per bushel. In 1812, the price of hops was this much per bushel. In 1815, a massive tank of beer exploded in the middle of London and sent a tidal wave of porter down Oxford Street. What? In 1816, the price of beer was... And I would pan out all those interesting stories that were buried in all this detail. This storytelling knack took over, and I thought, well, that's the important thing here. And linking together all these stories about how the history of beer was the history of ordinary British people, not kings or queens or generals, but people in the street, that beer, you couldn't tell their story without telling the story of beer. And so that's what the first book was. And I remember being interviewed by it after it came out, and someone said, your love of beer is apparent, but where did your love of history come from? And I said, well, I haven't got a love of history. And then I thought about the book and went, oh God, yeah. Oh, well, I guess the love of history came from writing this book. So it kind of set me on that path, really.
Just to take you back to this thing to my right, which is your wall that's full of post-it notes, you mentioned that you started doing this when you wrote Shakespeare's Local.
Yeah.
That is a whole book telling the story of history through the eyes of a pub, the Georgian in London Bridge. Why did you start doing this for that book? What changed between the one before it and Shakespeare's Local that forced your hand here?
I think the two books before that had a very, very straight narrative. The book I wrote before that was Hops and Glory, which was the story of my journey to India with a barrel of IPA by sea. So I was taking IPA on its traditional sea voyage for the first time in 140 years. And so the path of that book was very clear. I pick up the barrel of beer in Burton-on-Trent, I get on a boat, I go on several different boats, I have various mishaps, I arrive in India, we open the beer, the end. You know, so it was a very, very straightforward narrative. And with Shakespeare's Local, you could sort of think, well, when I started writing that, the straightforward narrative of the pub itself was about 3,000 words long. You know, the pub was probably built around this time. It burnt down in this year. It was rebuilt here. It was taken over by so-and-so here. And here it is in the present day. And it's like, well, the narrative history of this pub is really, that's not the book. The story is what went on around the pub, and there's all its literary links. I was having to learn a whole bunch of new stuff I hadn't ever learned before about architecture, so I could talk about why the pub looked the way it did and how that changed over the years, looking at things like carbon dating wooden beams and stuff like that. There was the history of Borough itself, because, you know, the pub is like this constant fixed point in a district which has just changed beyond recognition time and time and time again, because that's what happens in London. It's like layers and layers of history just on top of each other. So it ended up with a lot of different facets in it. And I thought, well, how do I pull this all together? And so that's where I started this idea of, like, right, one colour post-it for literary connections, one colour post-it for the architecture and the bricks and mortar of the pub, and so on. And it's like, right, each chapter's got to have a mix of all these things. Because when I wrote my first, actually, it was after my first draft, my wife read the first three chapters and came in tears saying, this is the best thing you've ever written, I absolutely love it. And then I gave her the next three chapters and she said, I can't read this, it's unreadable, it's a total mess. Because I'd gone from sort of some fairly kind of high vaulting, I talked about confidence earlier, and I took some risks in the first three chapters. And showed off, basically, as a writer. I was trying things. I thought, this is either going to be rubbish or it's going to be great. Let's just see what happens. And then after the pyrotechnics, I then got down into, right, this was the building style of popular buildings in this era, and da-da-da-da-da. And so it just completely changed from one style to the next after three chapters. And it went from being funny and broad-ranging to being incredibly dense and detailed. And I thought, that doesn't work. There needs to be a bit of everything in each chapter. It needs to be a bit smoother than that. So there's There's always a joke waiting for you at the end of reading something about architectural dimensions and things like that. I think every writer eventually finds their time of day, and it varies massively. And for me, my key time is between 8 a.m. and noon. If I don't get a good slog in that time period, I've lost the day, basically. So when I'm working on a piece of writing, I like to be up as early as I can. I like to be at my desk sometime between 7 and 8. And then I found that real discipline works in terms of timing and allocation. So I'm quite anal about it. And I think the more disorganised and flighty you are, the more structure you have to put in to kind of bring you back. So it's not that I'm a very anal person, it's that this is what I have to do in order to get the most out of myself. So I found there was this study of lots of different types of habits for effectiveness. And they looked at all these different crappy books that you can buy in W.H. Smith's about management effectiveness and stuff. And the one constant principle was if you divide your time up into 25-minute segments and then force yourself to take a break, then you're more productive than if you do anything else. So I set a timer on my iPhone, 25, so 8 o'clock, like 25 minutes. And when the alarm goes off, if I'm in the middle of a sentence, if I've had the greatest thought I've ever had, I stop, go and make myself a cup of tea, tidy something up, come back 5-10 minutes later, set another 25 minutes. And the focus that gives me is incredible. By the time I get to 12, midday, 1 o'clock, the result of that incredible long period of great focus means I'm absolutely knackered. And then I'm useless for anything after that. And so when I'm smack in the middle of a book, that's the useful writing time gone by lunchtime. The afternoon will be maybe doing some reading. If I'm far on in a book, it'll be kind of reading over drafts of what I've written and correcting them. If I'm a bit earlier in the book, it'll be reading some of the source material. I tend to kind of start and go wild off in all different tangents. This reminds me a little bit of that. Or this reminds me a bit. Maybe I could bring in a little bit of postmodernism here. Maybe I could go and kind of go and talk about the changing lineup of the Sugar Babes in relation to buildings and things like that. And so I'll go off and do all that reading in the afternoon, have a break, have a nice long walk. I love walking for the mental kind of sorting that happens. You know, if you've been dealing with a lot of ideas and a lot of thoughts and getting a lot of stuff down for a few hours, going for an hour's walk, especially at this time of year when it's cold and you feel it slap onto your face, everything just gets sorted out and put in the right place in your head. And if I'm having trouble getting over a particular piece of writing, if I think I don't know quite how to handle this, I can't unravel this particular knot in the narrative, if I'm out on a walk, halfway through the walk, it'll just happen and sort itself out in my back brain. And that'll be it normally. But what I then do at the start and the finish of a book is do a writing retreat somewhere on the coast on my own. And I take that discipline even further and just make it, back when we were doing A-levels and degree exams, everyone had multicoloured sheets of revision timetables and you'd spend longer putting your timetable together than you'd actually do any work. And it gets a bit like that for me writing a book. And if I'm on my own on a retreat doing that, then the evening will be going to a pub with a pile of manuscript or a book and reading and planning what I'm going to write the next day. And so it'll be a kind of round-the-clock exercise at that point.
That's amazing that you get away with that. I'm going to escape to... No, I am doing research. I'm just going to escape to the pub every night. That's quite tremendous. So in the evenings, while you are still writing, when you've had your walk, you've let things process, you've wriggled free any problems and kinks that you had, is that it? Are you still thinking? Are you still making notes? How does it end for the day for you? Are you not happy till you've got a certain amount of words done?
I do measure it, not as obsessively as I used to. I think you have to measure progress by word count, actually. And it's quite funny. I'll do the first 20,000 words incredibly quickly, because that'll be often kind of getting the whole structure down, getting the whole thing lined up, and I think, oh yeah, this is going really, really well. And I've probably got a word target somewhere between 80 and 100,000 words for the book. And I think, oh, this is great, you know. And Then if I go on a writing retreat and I'm really sticking to that discipline, I can write 3,500 words a day, every day, and you really see it piling up. But then we get to the middle of it, and you're measuring this word count, and you're going, right, okay, there's the end, there's the beginning, there's the end, here's what I've got to do. And you'll sit there for a couple of weeks doing 3,000 words a day, 3,000 words a day, and at the end of the day, you'll go, I'm no closer to the finish than I was at the start. And after a couple of weeks of that, you start to go a bit mad, and you're going, I'm writing and writing and writing all these words, and I'm not getting closer to the end of the book. What's happening here? And then as you get closer to the end, then it picks up again. And when I do my retreat, when a book's nearly finished, I can write 40,000 words in 10 days and just get it all done. And then, obviously, it needs a ton of editing after that. But it's just kind of a... I do compare it to running a marathon, and the way that that is a... I say this from watching people who run marathons. but when you look at long-distance runner athletes, it's more about the mental game than it is about your physical fitness. And I think writing a book is like that. It's about the stamina of being able to do it day after day after day when you feel like you're not getting any further through the process. And having this overarching strategy going, no, this is fine. If I keep doing this, I will get to the end. And then just not breaking down in the middle. Because there's a point where you've got the whole thing in your head and there's no room for anything else. And someone asks you what you want for your tea and the whole thing comes crashing down. you think, I've lost it now. I can't remember what I'm writing about anymore. Because it just takes up your entire brain. And so it's just this kind of, it is the mental discipline of it, which I think I've become obsessed on.
Is there anything else aside from the walking? Is there anything else, a little quirk, something that you think might be individual to you that helps you every day just to get your story down? Do you like a cup of tea at 11 o'clock or something, really niche?
There's one thing that I know is not unique to me, but I've got my own version of it. I can remember when the His Dark Materials trilogy came out, reading an interview with Philip Pullman, and this kind of conversation where it's like, well, I go to my shed every morning and I only write with this particular pen on a American style yellow legal pad, and that's how I do my writing. I thought, what a pretentious twat. And I find myself now 15 years later, I will only ever write with Uniball eye pens, and not just the fine one, it has to be the micro one. This pen, no other pen, and I have to have a Moleskine notebook. And I have to have my particular structure with that. Otherwise, I can't do it. When I'm out in the field, when I'm making notes, when I'm traveling, doing things like that, if someone gives me a notebook, I'm like, fuck off. I need a Moleskine. And if I fill my Moleskine when you're sort of in the middle of Prague or something like that on a brewery visit, it's like, oh, no. What's going to happen now?
I need to go home now.
I need another Moleskine before I can carry on work. So I think all writers have a version of that. But that's my one.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, everyone. I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently. Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. and they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
We'll get back into it with Pete in just a sec. First, it's my weekly call for a little bit of help. If you're enjoying the show, the wide range of authors and writers that we are bringing to you, if any of the tips that you've heard from the over 90 episodes have made any difference to the way you plan your day and tell your stories, please do let us know by giving a little bit back over at patreon.com/writersroutine. Just a couple of dollars a month really help us carry on, help us continue to bring you as many episodes as we can, as frequently as possible, with some of the best writers that I can manage to get out there and see. You get a little bit of thanks for you saying thanks, some merch is in there, badges, bookmarks, that kind of stuff, and you just get to know that you're helping out what I think is obviously the world's greatest writing podcast. I hope you feel the same way too. Just let us know, pay back what you can. At just a dollar or so a month, anything really helps. It's patreon.com/writersroutine. There are other ways that you can get involved as well, by retweeting and having a chat with me over on Twitter. Follow us, it's @writerspod there. Also, I've slightly spruced up the website. Now, I've not gone miles away. I've not gone really, really far with this. It's just I learned the words search... Oh, God, be prepared to be bored. I've heard the words search engine optimization about a billion times over the last week, so I'm really pushing ahead with that over on the website. I'd like to know what you think. I think I've made it a little bit easier for you to find what you want. It's a work in progress, though, so do bear with it. But let me know what you think. There's a contact form on there, too. Click on it. It's writersroutine.com. And also leave a review for the show over on Apple Podcasts. That really helps everything. Right, now I'm done being a beg. Let's get back to it with our guest on this week's Writers Routine, Pete Brown. He's been British Beer Writer of the Year 3 times, a fantastic historical and social commentator. We're chatting mostly about his newest book, Pie Fidelity. This half of the show is quite British. I don't mean that to put you off. And it's fantastically British. It's about British food, and it's about Only Fools and Horses, it's about the Sugar Babes, and we hear why Pete is so passionate about those things and why he wanted to show that through his writing. We also talk about research in this half of the show and figure out exactly how he knows what to look for in all the books that he ends up trawling through while writing. And we pick things up talking about ideas. He constantly has new ones pop into his head. So how does he decide what he's going to work on next?
That's the hardest part. That is absolutely the hardest part of the whole thing. And that's where I'm in that process at the moment. Because if you were to kind of gift wrap me a subject area, and so, which is actually what happened with Shakespeare's Local, my editor said, we should tell the history, we should do a social history through one pub, don't you think? And I said, yes, and I went to choose the pub.
That's a fantastic idea, isn't it?
It really is.
You need to, I hope you've never stopped thanking that editor.
No, exactly.
what a pitch line that is.
So that's perfect. So if he gives me that idea, so the social history of several centuries using one pub as its focus, I'm like, right, fine, got it. And yeah, I can just go away and I can do it. Getting that idea in the first place is awful sometimes. Sometimes it just comes to me. Hops and Glory, I'm going to recreate the voyage of India Pale Ale. Literally, so many people say this, who write the kind of narrative non-fiction blokey quest stories. But that was literally me and a mate in a pub. And he said, you should do a big beer journey. And I said, oh, there aren't any big beer journeys because beer doesn't travel. Oh, hang on. And that was it. There was the book fully formed in my head. But the more I write, the more I think, well, I know that whatever idea I land on, I'm going to be able to do this approach, take this approach to it, and I'm going to come up with something nice. But what's the idea? And with Pie Fidelity, it was an interesting one because it was I'm passionate about it because it was staring me in the face all along. And it was so it's my second book with Penguin on in particular books. And you know, when Penguin commissioned The Apple Orchard, which was a book previous to that, I felt like, you know, my football team's Barnsley, and I felt like a striker of a Barnsley being signed up by, you know, Liverpool or something. I thought, I've made it, you know, being published by the only publisher that most people can name. And And what was also brilliant is my editor there really saw the book inside the book, and she saw me as a writer and said, no, I don't want you going down that route. I want you to focus on this. I want you to focus on your personal journey, your experience, because that's where your writing shines. I was like, great, okay. And we did The Apple Orchard. And the first edit on that, she said, Pete, love the book. The only thing is, it's called The Apple Orchard. I've just done a word count on it. The word cider is mentioned twice as often as the word apple. Do you think you can kind of rebalance it a little bit? And so The Apple Orchard was great, and it got Book of the Week on Radio 4, and it won some awards and stuff. But afterwards, it's like, right, Pete, really like your writing, really like you, love working with you. What else have you got apart from beer and cider? And I was like, right, okay. Give it a rest on the alcoholic drinks for a little bit. What if you wrote about something else that's nothing to do with beer or cider? And so I thought, oh, well, what else do I like? So what do I do when I'm not writing? What do I do when I'm not in the pub or thinking about beer? Well, there's my sourdough bread, which I make, and I like doing that. And my curries, you know, I like making curry and stuff. And there's going out. I'm like, oh, my God, I'm a foodie. And I realised that when I'm not concentrated on beer, I'm thinking about food. Mm. And the thing about British food is a rant that I've had for a very long time. And it's very similar to my first book. A big thing about Man Walks Into a Pub was British pub culture and British beer styles are revered around the world. And we're the only people in the world who think that British beer is a bit shit. You know, we're the only country in the world where our national beer is not a beer that was brewed in this country. Mm. You know, if you go to America, it's Budweiser. You go to France, it's Kronenbourg. You go to Czech Republic, it's Pilsner Urquell. Here, it's either Cowley, which is Canadian, or Foster's, which is Australian, or, you know. Yeah. And then when it came to thinking about food, I thought, well, British food is exactly the same as that. We're the only country in the world where if someone from another country goes, your food's terrible, we go, yeah, no, it is, isn't it? Yeah, it's terrible. It's awful, our food. And even when people say, well, you know, London is such a vibrant place for cuisine and food now. It's one of the best cities in the world to go out eating. It's like, because we've got so many different other ethnic cuisines here. Yeah, we've got 98 different nationalities represented in the London restaurant and food cart scene, which is more than any other city apart from New York. And it's like, yeah, but what about traditional British food? Yeah, well, that's terrible, isn't it? It's like, no, it's not. Yes, there are terrible examples of it. You can get a revolting fish and chips in the centre, in the West End, in a tourist pub in the West End. But I've had terrible steak frites in the middle of Paris. I've had terrible pasta in the middle of Rome. You know, it's. But if you get a good Sunday roast or a good fish and chips, it's as good as anything else in the world. And why don't we champion that? So the idea was there and came out of that, really.
When did you start writing it?
I started writing the book, knowing that I was writing that book, in spring 2016? Yeah, spring 2016.
I only ask that, and this is nothing to do with anything that I was meant to talk about, it's just a note. Was there at all a worry, you writing a book about what makes a part of Britain so great, did you have a worry about how that would go down in the current climate where there's this distinct idea that if you enjoy anything about being British, you're almost, you know, you're a Brexity nationalist, that kind of stuff.
That became the first. I've got a big book here. Actually, it must have been spring 2017 when I started it. I've got a big book here where when I'm struggling with a...
That's right, you can, yeah.
When I'm struggling to come up with an idea, I start to sketch things out here. This is my post-it notes when they... In fact, this is High Fidelity when I took it away to finish writing it. But back here, book idea. Something about patriotism. The patriotic omnivore, gourmand, Epicurean. And so the start of the book was trying to reclaim pride in your country and pride in your culture from the far right. See, can I be a progressive, internationalist, socialist, pro-European person and say, I think Britain is brilliant at this stuff? Because those two ideas really don't sit well together. No. But they do sit well, they sit perfectly well together in most of the countries around the world. No, I could be a French radical socialist, pro-EU, passionate internationalist and say French cheese is the best in the world, and no one would bat an eyelid. If as a British person I say that, it's like, all right, Nigel, steady on, you know.
Take the pint out of your hand, yeah. Yeah. Kind of stuff. So you've got this big idea. This is what you want to do. You want to talk about what makes British food so great. Why have we lost that sense of our identity? It's a big idea. What happens? Day one, where do you start your research? How do you start writing? How does that idea become this big wall of post-it notes to my right?
Yeah, so, I mean, one of the things I love in the writing process, especially, like, one of the reasons I love about writing nonfiction was like, right, I'm going to write this. And then the idea kind of, it was missing an element. It was missing a hook. And then that arrived on New Year's Day when we're having a big Sunday roast with some friends. And I looked at the meal and thought, this meal is just such a brilliant meal. And thought, right, the structure of the book is 9 meals. And I go and I have the archetypal version of each of those meals. And so then there's a long list of about 20 different meals that gets whittled down to 9. And every conversation I have is like, oh, you got toad in the hole in there, haven't you? No, it was on the long list. It didn't make the short list. And everybody else's favorite foods seem to be on the long list, didn't make the short list. But once I got those meals, it's like, right, then go on to Amazon first, but then onto Abe Books, second-hand book aggregator. And I just bought, like, an entire shelf. I was just like, right, history of fish and chips, history of roast beef, history of crumble. And, you know, you get more hits on some than others. And for a day, I just ordered books, second-hand books, and that shelf just got populated with a whole new library of stuff on, like, food studies, the history of food in Britain, food culture, customs around food, cheese and culture, the rituals of dinner, the story of Britain through its cooking. And so all those books just kind of end up piled in. and it's like, great. The first thing I'm doing is I'm reading through these and making all notes. And at the same time, I'm going to plan, where am I going to go? Where am I going to go for my one fish and chips meal? Where am I going to go for my one full English breakfast? So it took two routes like that. And I did one of my writing weeks. I went down to a caravan in West Wales on this particular occasion. And I thought, and I took my pile of books with me. And I thought, right, I'm going to get through as many of these books as I can in the next 10 days. And I said, first, though, I've just got some thoughts buzzing around my head. I'll just get those out and down on paper. So I've captured my thoughts before I do all the reading and learn all the history. And a week later, I'd got 25,000 words of memoir. And I was like, where the hell did that come from? There was no mention of memoir in the proposal for the book. But I realized that when you talk to people about the meals that matter to them, you're talking to them about some very strong, incredibly strong memories, usually childhood memories or memories formed in adolescence. And mine were no different from anyone else's. And so in the end, about a quarter of the book was memoir. And the rest of it ended up getting structured around that. And it almost became a sort of autobiography through food, about my sort of early memories growing up in a poor working class community, going to university and my horizons widening and getting involved in the food and drink industry and thinking, what am I doing here? What's all this about? And contrasting my desire to make my own kimchi and my sourdough cultures in the fridge downstairs with my primal desire for a plate of fish and chips or a burger. You know? Sometimes I might have particular questions. Like, you know, with the British pub, it was, why did we start, why did we carry on drinking ale until the 1970s, 1980s, when everyone else in the world started drinking lager in the 1870s, 1880s? So sometimes it might be a question like that I need the answer to. Other times I'm just looking for the thing that leaps off the page, the tidal wave of beer going down the middle of Oxford Street, you know, and stories that just unlock things for me and send me on journeys as well. So I might start with something in a book and then Google it and end up on a Wikipedia page. And so, for example, what happened with Shakespeare's Local, I mentioned the Sugar Babes, was this question around when a building was built. You know, if you want to write a history of a pub, the first question is, when was it built then? Yeah. And the answer to that is hugely more complex than you think it is. And so I remembered this thing about Trigger's Broom from Only Fools and Horses, where Trigger's got this broom, and he gets accommodation from the council for using the same broom for 20 years. And they say, well, how did you keep it in such good condition for 20 years? And he goes, well, I changed the head 5 times and the handle 3 times. It's like, well, it's not the same broom, is it? Yes, it is. Look, here's a picture with me 20 years ago. And then I remember the Sugar Babes had a similar thing. You know, when the three original Sugar Babes were no longer in the band, there's still a band called the Sugar Babes, which is a totally different band than it was. And then the three original members got back together as a different band, but they're not the Sugar Babes, even though they're the Sugar Babes. And so the thing about the George Inn was, well, it was built, then it burnt down, then it got built again, and then it burnt down. And then the thing now is, it's like, well, the current building's been there since 1676. It's like, no, it hasn't. That bit has, and that bit has. That fireplace has. These wooden beams here have. But that bit got replaced in 1830, and that bit got replaced in 1920. So is it the same pub or is it not the same pub? Is it the same pub as it was in 1666? Is it the same pub as it was before it got burned down in 1666? And then I found out that this conundrum goes right back to ancient Greece and the paradox of Theseus's ship. And Aristotle kind of went through this paradox of, if you've got a ship and the planks rot and you replace all the planks, is it the same ship or not? And then if you could build another facsimile of a ship from the old rotted planks, is that the original ship or the one that's had all the planks replaced? And so Aristotle solved this problem with... So I find myself talking about ancient Greek philosophy, starting with the question, how old is this pub? I take in Sugar Babes, Only Fools and Horses, and ancient Greek philosophy to get to the answer. And that's the kind of flight of fancy that I love. Not everyone does, I have to say, but that's what I'm looking for when I start reading.
How did you solve the question? This is just for me, really, but it's an interesting one of identity, isn't it? Like,
yes.
Who is that thing? What is that thing? How did you answer it? What did you come across?
Aristotle posited these four states of being. And I can't remember what they all are, but one is it made from the same materials as it used to be? Mm-hmm. Two is it made to the same plan and design that it was? Three is something else, and four is does it have the same purpose that used to be? And so if you build a pub and it burns to the ground, and then you rebuild the pub to the same plan using the same materials, it's being used for the same purpose, and it's in the same place, then as far as Aristotle's concerned, the pub after it's been rebuilt is the same pub as the pub before it got burnt down.
What if it does all that, but it's renamed?
That's a very good question. I would then say it's a different pub.
And of course, what everyone that's British knows about pubs, the second thing you ask after when was it born was... did Dick Turpin go there? And the answer is almost immediately yes. It was because they all say that, don't they?
They do. Yeah. Turpin, Dickens, and Orwell.
Yeah.
Visited every single pub in the UK.
And there's about 10 that claim to be the oldest pub in the country.
Yeah.
I know, it's crazy.
But one of the joys of research and this idea that you're just exploring and foraging and prospecting when you do research for a non-fiction book, the way that I write them, there's an amazing thing in the British Library now that you can. They've got newspapers going back to 1600 digitized as PDFs, and they're word searchable. So I first found this out when I was writing my book on IPA, and I typed into this database, India Pale Ale, your search has returned 16,000 hits, and I spent days just going, most of them classified ads in newspapers, but you learn things from the classified ads. And so I typed in George in Southwark, and one of the first hits I got was a newspaper from 1737, and I got the whole front page up. And there was a story about a dead baby being found in a ditch behind the George Inn. It was a very sad story. But the thing about that was it was the middle of the gin craze. And women who would go into prostitution to get the money to pay for gin, if they got pregnant, they would basically murder or abandon the babies, which is why the Coramsfield Hospital was set up to kind of save a lot of the lives of these babies and so on. So there's an interesting story in and of itself. And was the George ever used as a brothel? Possibly not, but certainly all the other pubs along the bankside were brothels. And then I looked at the front page, and above that story was a story about Dick Turpin holding up a coachload of travellers. And it wasn't travellers from the George. There was no link to the George there. But I imagined sitting in the coffee room in the George that morning, about to get on a stagecoach, reading the story about Dick Turpin holding up a stagecoach and sitting there going, well, I'm getting on a stagecoach in 2 hours. I wonder if we'll get held up. And suddenly I had this picture of this place in 1737 that morning when you're reading that story. And an anonymous patron just kind of turning the page going, oh, that's a sad story about the dead baby. But Turpin, he's at large. So and suddenly you're there. You're there in that period.
And that's a key part of the stories that you are telling in the books that you're writing. They need to transport me into a place, into a time, into an atmosphere, be that in the past, be that, you know, halfway to India carrying a keg of beer. And that's all to do with tone and language and the yes. voice that you are telling the story with. How much thought do you give to the voice that you are telling the story with, the actual words that are on the page?
That's the aspect of writing that's really surprised me. When a rope man walks into a pub, which I struggle to read these days if I pick it up, I'm so embarrassed by it. And I thought, well, I'm writing this because I'm a fluent writer. I can put words together in the right order. I'm an engaging, readable writer. My prose style is quite simple. But I'm never going to be a writer. And then around the time of Hops and Glory, my prose starts to become a lot more lyrical because just the things I saw were amazing and I was looking for words to help describe them. And the biggest surprise for me has been the development of my tone of voice. Because it's still simple and readable. People still say to me, oh, reading your book is just like talking to you. It's like, no, it's not. It's not. You know, transcribe my speech and you'll see how different it is. But it's good that people think that. But yeah, I spend a lot of time, again, back to the advertising thing, I spend a lot of time thinking about tone of voice. It's a key aspect on an advertising brief for an ad. You know, do we want this ad to be funny or serious? Do we want it to be... Do we want this brand to come across as your best mate or your bank manager or your dad? You know, what's the personality? And so I do think about that all the time. And then I'm influenced by other writers who I read who I'm deeply impressed by. So... central for me is Orwell, just the front and center of everything, just the precision and the economy of words. I was going to say something I've learnt, it's something I will carry on learning till the day I die, basically. And just the simplicity and clarity of ideas. I don't want to impress people with how clever I am as a writer. I want people to get what I'm talking about instantly, and I want them to like it, and I want to be engaged by it and inspired by it. And I want to make them laugh. And I want to make them interested. And something a lot of people said about my writing is when you read, it's almost like learning by stealth. You're with me on my hapless journey as I'm pratfalling all over the place and stuff like that. And you get to the end and go, hang on a minute, I've just learned a shit ton about the East India Company in the early 19th century, you know. And so that's how I like to try and do it. I as a writer, I want to be liked. I want people to go, oh, he'd be a brilliant bloke to spend time with. But I also want to be clever, but I don't want to wear it heavily. I want to wear it lightly. So that's kind of my guiding principle.
And that is it for this week's Writer's Routine. Thank you so much to Pete for having me over, letting me see his Writer's Routine, giving me the full tour, and sparing the time in his busy morning to chat things through. You can find everything you need to know about Pete and his newest book, Pie Fidelity, over on our new and improved website, which is writersroutine.com. New and improving, I should say. Still a work in progress. Bear with it, please. While you're there, you can get in touch. Use the contact form at writersroutine.com. If you've enjoyed what you've heard today, maybe you picked up some tips that will help you in the way that you write and tell your stories, I'd love for you to just say thanks by pledging whatever you can over at patreon.com/writersroutine. Give us a follow on Twitter at writerspod. Make sure you leave us a review on the Apple Podcast Store as well. And I'll see you next week, where we are chatting to the historical mystery author S.D. Sykes. It's on the way on Writer's Routine. I'll see you then. Bye!
Hey.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
When everyone's on the same page, getting things done at work is easy. No matter what you do or what industry you're in, how you communicate is key. Everything you type is equally important to collaboration, and Grammarly can help. Think of it as your AI writing partner, empowering you to communicate effectively and efficiently, so you can make a bigger impact in the workplace. 96% of Grammarly users say it helps them craft more impactful writing. And as the gold standard of responsible AI, Grammarly is your secure AI writing partner that allows your team to make their point and move faster. By understanding your writing in context, Grammarly provides relevant, personalized suggestions. And with tone suggestions, you can navigate even the most difficult work conversations. You can also save time from spending hours editing drafts to just seconds with one click. Sign up and download Grammarly for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's GRAMMARLY.com/podcast. Easier said, done.